Good evening, everyone. My name is Ayşe Çubukçu. I'm assistant professor in human rights in the Department of Sociology at LSE. On behalf of LSE Human Rights, I'm delighted to welcome you to the school and introduce our speakers tonight, Professor Nadia Ali and Professor Toby Dodd, who will be talking about 50 years of war on Iraq and its effects on Iraqi society. Before I introduce our speakers, I would like to thank Hanin Namne from the Department of Sociology and also Emma Glassy for all their work in putting this event together. The order of the night will be that each speaker will speak for about 25 minutes, and then we're going to have a lively Q&A if you have questions. Let me also inform you that the event is being audio recorded. There will be a podcast of the event posted online next week, technology permitting. If you'd like to tweet about the event, any ideas being discussed here, the suggested hashtag is LSEIraq. Our event will end at about 8 p.m., so we'll leave about 45 minutes for the Q&A. Professor Toby Dodge will be speaking first, and the title of his talk tonight is Violence and the Rise of a New Sectarianism in Iraq After 2003. Professor Dodge is the director of the LSE Middle East Center and a professor in International Relations Department at LSE. He has been researching and writing on Iraq for the last 20 years. Any of you working on Iraq will be familiar with his work. His publications include Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied, and also Iraq from War to a New Authoritarianism. We're hoping he'll be reflecting on the recent elections as well. Professor Nadia Ali will speak next, and she's a professor of gender studies at the Center for Gender Studies at SOAS. Her main research interests revolve around feminist activism, transnational migration and diaspora mobilization, war, conflict, and peace, as well as art and cultural studies, mainly with reference to Iraq, Egypt, Turkey, and the Kurdish women's movement. Her publications include What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq. Another book, Women and War in the Middle East, Transnational Perspectives, which she co-edited with Nicola Pratt. Another one called Iraqi Women, Untold Stories from 1948 to the Present, published by Zed Books. And Secularism, Gender and the State in the Middle East, which was published by Cambridge University Press. She's also the author of numerous book chapters and journal articles. Her co-edited book with Deborah Al-Najjar, titled Where Iraqis, Aesthetics and Politics in a Time of War, won the 2014 Arab American Book Prize for nonfiction. She's a member of the Feminist Review Collective and is on the editorial board of COAL, a journal of body and gender research. I must note that I'm very sad Nadia is leaving London for Brown University next year. That's public, so I can express my sadness here. So without further ado, I invite Professor Dodge to present his work.
I'm going to just shout.
You want to? You don't need it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for all turning up on what is a beautiful summer's night in the middle of exam season. I told my own students that if they didn't come, I'd dock them 5% of all their exams. And you may wonder why I could do that, because marking is strictly anonymous. Well, none of them are here, so they all get 5% docks. More importantly, and joking aside, I stress, it's great to be here tonight discussing the transformation of Iraq over the last 15 years. And I'd like to thank Aisha and Hanin for putting the organization, the ideas, bringing you all together, and my old friend and colleague, Nadia, who she and I have been debating Iraqi politics for at least 15, if not 20 years. I'm sad to hear that she's succumbed to the myriad attractions of the United States, and so she's moving into the belly of the beast, and we'll mourn her departure long and hard. So what we've been asked to do today is to discuss how the war and its aftermath change Iraqi perceptions of living, dying, and being part of civil society in Iraq. And of course, that's difficult for me because I'm not an Iraqi. So what I thought I'd do is loosely hang my lecture around, or my talk, my intervention, around four books written by Iraqis reflecting on different socio-economic periods of Iraq. The first is by Haifa Zangana, Dreaming of Baghdad. The second is by Noor al-Radia, Baghdad Diaries. Zuhair al-Jazeri, The Devil You Don't Know, Going Back to Iraq, and the wonderful book by Sinan Antoun, The Corpse Washer. So I'm going to refer to these as I go through my lecture, trying to bring in an Iraqi voice. Now, as Aisha said, I think the first point I want to make before we get into the really pessimistic stuff is that on the 12th of May, Iraq had its fifth national elections since regime change in 2003. Now, undoubtedly, on the downside, turnout was 44.5% compared to roughly 60% last time, signaling, I think, two things. Firstly, an active boycott where civil society activists said, why on earth go to the polls when all you're being presented with are the same kleptocratic, corrupt, sclerotic elite that has dominated Iraq since 2003. Secondly, Ayatollah Sistani, the chief, the most senior religious figure in Shia Islam in Iraq, gave a wonderfully ambiguous fatwa, as it were, but it couldn't have been a fatwa because it didn't actually demand anything of his adherents, saying, look, if you want to vote, it's up to you. And then finally, I think, and most dominatingly, that the stay-at-home, the people who stayed at home didn't vote, just didn't think it was worth it, didn't think turning out to the ballot box was going to deliver any change in their lives. And I think that is profoundly depressing, given the territory we're just about to travel over. But in spite of widespread abuses, vote buying, intimidation, and some violence, no one knows who's going to win the elections before the elections take place. The elections weren't widespreadly rigged outside probably the Kurdish region of Iraq, and no one knows, least of all the serving prime minister, who's going to be prime minister next. In addition, those with the highest vote were a somewhat bizarre coalition of the Shia Islamist Sadrist Party, run by Muqtada al-Sadr, and the avowedly secular Iraqi Communist Party. Now, this coalition was born out of the widespread protest movements that swept up from Basra in the summer of 2015 and came to dominate Baghdad. And these protest movements, which were the electoral manifesto for this coalition, were an abolishment of the Muhassasa system, the sectarian apportionment system, an attack on corruption, and a demand for the removal of that post-2003 governing elite with all their follies and corruption and violence, and a technocratic government. So we could look at the victors of this election, albeit on a low turnout, as pointing towards hope and transformation. Right, well, firstly, the first book I want to look at is Dreaming of Baghdad. And that this book is actually written about Iraq in the 70s. And I want to go back before regime change in 2003, because unlike the fantasies of the neoconservative politicians around George W. Bush in 2002, who planned the election, planned the invasion, Iraq wasn't suddenly turned in to a tabula rasa after the invasion and the removal of the Ba'athist regime. It had suffered 35 years of some of the most brutal and effective authoritarian violence that any regime could deploy. And I think Zangana is an amazing woman. She came from a middle-class family, was training to be a pharmacist, And then she joined the Iraqi Communist Party just as it went into alliance with the Ba'ath Party in a national pact, but she was on the wing that didn't accept that, was protesting. As she says, "I tried to write about lives and deaths of young people who were able to foresee the horrible damage that the Iraqi regime was inflicting on its people long before the First and Second Gulf Wars." And it's not an easy read. It tells a tale of a very brave, idealistic group of young people who were brought in to incarceration and tortured until they either broke, confessed, and told of their other colleagues, or died in immense pain. But the big takeaway I think you take from reading that book is, as she argues, that torture left deep scars on the collective memories of Iraqis, that the footprint of that 35 years still remains to some extent. Now, I'm not saying what a lot of the Iraqi governing elites say, that somehow the Ba'athists are the hidden hand behind the trouble that engulfed Iraq after 2003, that would be Nouri al-Maliki, the previous prime minister argument, or somehow that Iraqis aren't able to flourish and organize civil society or democracy. But what I am saying is that the footprint of those 35 years is very heavy across those that can still remember it, i.e. those that were adults before 2003. Now, the second book is Baghdad Diaries. Now, Al-Rida died on August 2004 of leukemia that she thought she may well have contracted, like a lot of Iraqis, because of the depleted uranium used in the 1991 liberation of Kuwait by the United States. However, I think the argument in Baghdad Diaries is Iraq under siege after 1991 through to 2003, under the most thoroughgoing and destructive sanctions any country has ever been placed under. And she documents with a wry humor, but also a rising desperation, the economic transformation of Iraq. Ironically, as the regime of Saddam Hussein learns to be a more effective repressor under sanctions, it pulls out of society, strips the healthcare system of resources, and Iraqis have to fend for themselves while pumping what's left of its resources into that roughly million members of the population that Saddam Hussein thought was central to his rule, to his continued power base. So I think these two books, very good reads, very powerful testimonies to Iraq before 2003. But then we go on, of course, to the kind of imperial triumphalism of the United States and its scattering of allies, sadly, including Tony Blair and the British Army, that invade Iraq in March and April 2003 and reach Baghdad in the first week of April 2003. And of course, the first thing they're faced with is the great irony that these 13 years of sanctions were designed to trigger the collapse of the Iraqi state. And just as those Marines get to Baghdad, they pull down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdous Square with the stars and stripes over his face. There is a collapse of the state, the very thing that they were trying to trigger before they invaded, the very institutions they were seeking to seize and run Iraq through. Now, you've got two dynamics here for how ordinary Iraqis perceive of themselves after 2003. Firstly, you have a massive explosion of celebration. The tyrant is gone. The Ba'ath Party has been disassociated. The army has fled in defeat. The Secret Service has scuttled back under the rocks that it deserved to hide in. But that then quickly metamorphized into an explosion of looting that the United States didn't have the ability or the desire to control. So 17 of Iraqi government's 23 central ministry buildings were taken apart and destroyed. I was there in Baghdad in May 2003, and when I speak to my young colleagues and they say they're anarchists, I say I've witnessed anarchy, albeit a very disorganized form and a highly armed form, and it's bloody scary. And from that point of view, that you could see the state disappearing before your eyes in a sense of lawlessness. The wonderful Donald Rumsfeld quote, freedom is messy, and free people are what they are free to do what they want to do, and what that urban, repressed, poor section of Baghdad was free to do was take home the contents of the Iraqi state. And the scrap metal prices in Iran and Turkey during April and May 2003 actually dropped because so much scrap metal was being taken out of the walls and ceilings and buildings of the Iraqi government and put into the regional market. So I think the first big thing is that the invasion didn't go as planned, that liberation was a fleeting joy for the Iraqi population, and then we get into something darker, more sinister. And of course, that destruction was exacerbated and accelerated by Paul Bremer, the so-called civilian administrator, who, when he got there, disbanded the Iraqi army and then purged the bureaucracy of the top four layers of the Ba'ath Party serving there. So basically, you have a state that seeks to exist. You could say almost a neoliberal fantasy, no state to interfere with individuals, no state to interfere with the market, but also no state to provide services, water, electricity, or law and order across the whole of Iraq. And I think the next book that I want to look at is another wonderful book by Zuhair al-Jazeri, The Devil You Don't Know, Going Back to Iraq. Now, Jazeri left into exile, I think, in 1979, and it's an incredibly moving book. He goes back after regime change and moves into the neighborhood that he left as a young man. And now I don't think he'd be, I think it's pretty obvious that he's a late middle-aged man. He goes back to the house where his parents lived and died, and he sleeps in his parents' bed, and he can't get to sleep because the dents that his mother and father have left in the mattress haunt his dreams. But more than that, what he sees is a state, a society descending into civil war. And I think he very powerfully describes that. The state stood paralyzed before the rise of armed militias, or rather the police were in total sympathy with the Mahdi army. Those demonstrations were not just a show of numbers, they were a show of power, allowing armed groups that had flourished, that had floundered for a while, to find momentum and overcome previous inactivity. Within days, the streets were beginning to take on the aspect of civil war. Again, as Jazeri was in Baghdad, I was in Baghdad, and the sense of lawlessness on the streets was palpable. Increasing firefights, bombs, the sense of a civil war coming. And the house that I was living in Ghazaliyeh, in a middle-class suburb of Baghdad, there was a sharp knock on the door, and two young men with cropped hairs asked to see the head of the house, and they said, "Sir, we're living in dangerous times." And he said, "Yes, we are." I said, "What can we do about it?" And they said, "Sir, we've blocked off either end of the street," and Jazeri describes something very similar happening in his neighborhood, a different neighborhood, "and we're going to stop suicide bombers and militias coming in." And so the head of the house I was living in said, That's wonderful, thank you." He said, "Sir, you know, we need to eat, and we need money for weapons and armaments, so just a weekly payment would be greatly appreciated." So behind the decent drapery of civil protection, neighborhood protection, there were two things going on. He didn't knock on the door and say, "Sir, we're protecting your street." He said, "Sir, as a member of a fellow religious minority, we're defending your street, and we're defending it against the religious majority. And sir, if you don't pay us, we'll be back and it won't be nice." So you have the sectarianization of Iraqi society in the face of lawlessness, and behind that, basically a protection racket. Violence flourishes, kidnapping flourishes, lawlessness flourishes. So the militias take to the streets, and then you have a rising drumbeat of quite appalling violence. Anyone with a strong stomach, and I really, really wouldn't advise it, could go to WikiLeaks and look at the significant acts log of the US military that was leaked to them. And you see them finding the most obscenely mutilated bodies of all ages, right down to the youngest, being pulled from the river in Baghdad that have been tortured in the most brutal and dehumanizing way. And this clearly wasn't torture designed to extract information. This was torture designed to terrify not the people who were dying, but the people who would pull them out of the river and see what had been done to them before they met their maker. So that next big theme about how life had been transformed from 2003 is lawlessness and civil war. The sense that your very survival depends on the coherence, this would be from 2004 or 5, probably through to 2007, your very survival, the ability to get your kids in and out of school, the ability to buy food, the ability to stay alive would depend on the coherence of sub-state groupings in your neighborhood, usually or most certainly organized around the violent assertion of sectarian identity, claiming to defend you from the sectarian other in Baghdad and justifying a violent civil war in terms of religious difference. And that was undoubtedly present, omnipresent, across Baghdad, down through into the south and up into the northwest. And of course, the next issue, the political secondary side to that, is what's called the Mahasasa system. The Mahasasa system is how the Americans organized the political structures in Iraq from 2003 onwards. Mahasasa is apportionment, or sectarian apportionment. And there's a wonderful quote in Sinan Antoon's The Corpse Washer, when the electricity momentarily comes back on in Baghdad in 2003, and he and his uncle are watching the telly, and they see the formation of the Iraqi Governing Council, the first allegedly receptacle of Iraqi sovereignty put together by the United States and the United Nations. And the United States very proudly said, this is the most representative body in Iraqi history. And when I heard that statement, I thought, why could it be representative? And when the hero of Sinan Antoon's book sees it on the telly, his uncle shouts, who the hell are these people? I don't know them. And of course, these people were picked, not because they had any skill in government, not because they had any legitimacy, partially because they were aligned to the United States, but primarily because they were supposed to represent the sectarian communities of Iraq. So what we see from 2003 onwards is the primordialization, the sectarianization of Iraqi politics as a structural force. So if you think about yourself, if you were an Iraqi, from 2003, possibly all the way through to these elections, and you're an Iraqi who may be secular, you're an Iraqi who may be nationalist, you're an Iraqi who doesn't want primarily to be identified in the terms of religious or ethnic difference. The parties that you could vote for, primarily up until this election, Ayadollah's Wefaq or Iraqiya formation, weren't doing very well. But also more sinisterly than that, the Mahasasa system, after each national election, 2005 twice, 2010, 2014, divided the government up, gave the ministries to ethno-sectarian parties, and you saw the payroll of those ministries go from 2003, maybe 750,000, right up to nearly 2.5 million. So if you wanted a job in one of the only employers in Iraq, you had to go to that ministry and prove that you were aligned with the party dominating. So economically, politically, and increasingly socially, you see the dividing lines in Iraqi society being re-engineered and restructured around sectarian lines. And in a very telling moment towards the end of Sinan Antoon's book, he's arguing with his auntie, and she raises her eyebrow and said, oh my, are you with us or are you with them? Don't you know he's a defender, or he's a defense lawyer for the Sunnis, my mother told her. I'm all by myself, he answered. Neither with you nor with them, I said. I kept silent after that time and tried to avoid such useless arguments. So what is Antoon saying? He's saying two things, that it's increasingly impossible during these periods to be non-aligned, to assert a secular citizenship, or to assert a citizenship that isn't defined by religion and its juxtaposition against a religious other. And that if you do try and do that, you're increasingly alone. You feel isolated, bereft, without the state, but without the support of a party. And you could argue that the rise of the Islamic State, that came a major player in the civil war that ran up to 2007, reconstituted it after 2011, and seized Mosul and lots of the northwest in 2014, is a direct result of that. That if you cut up Iraqi society in sectarian units, and if you then say roughly 20% of that, or 25%, the Sunni population are not only just Sunnis, but they're somehow complicit with Ba'athism or Takfiri Islamism, and therefore need to be treated with mistrust, and you push them out of access to government resources. It's no great surprise that out of that persecuted and alienated society, a small minority become radicalized and violent and put their lot in with Daesh or the Islamic State. So where does that leave us today in my last 3 minutes? I think I would recommend you reading all four of these books, and I've chosen not only because they're my favorite windows into the transformation of Iraqi society, but they're written with great humanity and insight and actually spotlight the bravery of idealistic Iraqis. And those clearly idealists exist. And it's not this bleak march towards violence and sectarian apportionment, that there are incredibly brave people and there are successes. Ayad Alawi's party got the plurality of votes in 2010 on an overtly secular platform. And whatever the outcome of the 2018 elections, Muqtada al-Sadr and his brief allies in the Iraqi Communist Party have got a plurality of votes in this election, asserting a secular transformationalist agenda. So there clearly is hope there. But the abject violence and terror and trauma that Iraq has gone through, probably since 1968 and certainly since 2003, has left a society riven apart, traumatized, and wondering what they can expect next. So it's no great surprise that less than half of them turned out at the ballot box. But out of that, nearly 2 million people voted for a better future on May the 12th, and we can only hope and support them in gaining that going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Dodge.
So I noticed, Toby, that sort of the writing was a bit... I'm going to try to stand here. Can you see me? Yeah? Is that okay? Okay, and the microphone is okay? Should I bring closer? Okay. So I really, really enjoyed Toby's talk, and I actually just finished reading another novel which would really fit in well, which is a recently translated Frankenstein in Baghdad. I don't know if you come across it, but I think that would work very well. And one reason I really appreciated the talk is that too often when we hear people speak about Baghdad, about Iraq more generally, it is as if there was no history. And I think it is so important to historicize the current situation, not only historicize it in terms of 15 years, but also the 35 years before, because similar to Professor Dodge, I'm very much convinced that we do not understand post-invasion Iraq without going back to the impact of both the Ba'ath regime, but also specifically the sanction regimes, which had a devastating impact on Iraqi society. So I'm acutely aware that this is quite a sort of classic gendered division of labor. So while you have received the kind of overall sort of historical and political context, I'm going to zoom in a bit and talk about The impact on women, gender relations. I'm talking a bit about youth and culture. And one of my questions, although I should say that increasingly I am losing hope, but what I'd like to argue is that for me it's not so much, you know, the elections or, you know, new creative political coalitions, but it is in the spheres of culture, it's in the spheres of art and sort of youth movements that I see glimmers of hope. And as a feminist, I also see glimmers of hope in relation to the Egyptian the Iraqi feminist movement. So I want to start out by sharing an anecdote. In March 2017, the Iraqi parliament and media experienced a huge uproar after female MP called for the promotion of polygamy in order to support and help the high number of widows, divorcees, and single women as a result of war and conflict. Jamila Al-Obeidi, a Sunni member of the Iraqi parliament from the National Coalition, convened a press conference encouraging women to denounce the culture of monogamy. Aside from demanding the lifting of legal restrictions making polygamy difficult, she recommended financial incentives to encourage the men and help them to marry more than one woman, and to double these incentives for those who marry a widow or a divorcee. Now, opinions amongst MPs, journalists, and the general public were extremely polarized in reaction to Al-Obeidi's statement. Many Sunni and Shia female MPs expressed their outrage at Al-Obeidi's suggestions, which in their view was demeaning to women, with one angry MP slapping her and even throwing a shoe at her, as you probably know, the ultimate form of humiliation in Iraqi culture. However, some journalists, writers, and religious figures praised Al-Obeidi and stressed the religious roots of her argumentation. Now, while this particular debate lacked the sectarian undertones of many other heated discussions and conflicts in contemporary Iraq, it illustrates both the centrality of gender issues in contestations about what people think of as the new Iraq, as well as the limitations of numerical representation in terms of women's political participation. And here I should say, in terms of numbers, Professor Dodge pointed out that the Iraqi Governing Council was all based on representation, both in terms of ethnic sectarian representation, but out of the 23 representatives, there were only three women. And when in the spring of 2004, a group of Iraqi women's rights activists went to then Ambassador Paul Bremer and said, "We Iraqi women, we actually make up the majority of the population. We carried a heavy burden during the sanctions regime, during the Ba'ath regime. We want to have an equal share in the new Iraq. We want to have," they asked for 40% representation in all political bodies. He turned to them and he said, "We don't do quotas." Okay. Which was, of course, very ironic, because it was all about quotas when it came to sectarian ethnic representation. And often when I go to the United States to give talks, there's someone in the audience who says, "But we made sure that Iraqi women had a quota of 25% that's enshrined in the Constitution." And I always have to remind my audience that it's despite U.S. objection that Iraqi women managed to get this 25% quota. So for a long time, when writing and researching Iraq, I felt that my main motivation had to be to challenge the prevailing media and policy narrative that what we see unfolding in Iraq in terms of gender-based violence, sectarianism, oppression of women, that was inherent in Iraqi culture, Muslim culture, Middle East culture, and as you know, it's often conflated. So for a long time, I was very much driven by challenging both, similar to Professor Dodge, the idea of sectarianism being inherent in Iraq and that Iraq was just a sort of, you know, artificial creation, but also challenging the idea that gender-based violence and gender-based oppression was something that was normal. And so I spent lots of time trying to show the impact of the occupation, the invasion, against the background of the impact of the atrocities by the Ba'ath regime, because I think that was a big, for me, many of us based in the UK during the anti-sanctions period, it was a big problem that many of the anti-sanctions activists and anti-war activists were glossing over the atrocities of the Ba'ath regime while being critical of the policies of this country and the United States. So now at the time, you know, the initial years, it was very much about documenting how the occupation was not only complicit, but an active perpetrator in different forms of gender-based violence. Right? But at the same time, it was also about showing how sectarianism was gendered, that whether it was a Shia Islamist group or Sunni Islamist group, when they were entering a neighborhood, the first things they were doing, giving out leaflets, forcing women to, I mean, most women were wearing anyway, they were not walking around in miniskirts, but forcing them to, you know, wear hijab, to wear conservative dress, putting pressure on women not to drive cars, not to go to work. And this was a systematic sort of symbolic gesture to show that a specific militia was controlling the neighborhood. It was through the control of women's bodies, women's dress codes, and women's sexuality. And one reason why I can't be cheerful and hopeful in relation to the recent election results is because I remember too well the Sadrist actually, I mean, their role in terms of both sectarian violence but also gender-based violence. So for me, and I know that might upset some of my Iraqi friends, I mean, I don't really understand the draw around this. Although, of course, I understand that right now it is linked to the wider, as Toby pointed out, to the wider movement against establishment, political establishment in Iraq that is associated with corruption, that is associated with sectarianism, and that's also associated with political authoritarianism. For many years, I mean, Iraq was very much in the media the first few years after the invasion. But then, I mean, I found myself, so from 2008, there was no interest in Iraq. All of a sudden, and certainly there was no interest in gender-based violence. And I have to say that although I not for a second want to diminish the terrible atrocities that Daesh have been involved with, especially with respect to Yazidi women, but I find it very hypocritical that all of a sudden there was an interest in gender-based violence in Iraq, because the gender-based violence we've seen unfolding in relation to Daesh did not just emerge out of a vacuum, but we had a long history of everyone either turning a blind eye to gender-based violence or being complicit or being directly involved. And when I say everyone, from, you know, the American occupation, you know, British army, the various political parties, the various militias, criminal gangs, and families as well. Now, telling the story of Iraq over the past 15 years is also telling the story of displacement and refugees. And this is very gendered as well. I mean, we have, this is after decades and decades of people leaving Iraq due to wars, due to conflict, due to political persecution, due to ethnic cleansing, especially Kurds. We now had, you know, various waves of, again, refugees leaving Iraq, but also internal displacement. And when you read any sort of reports about the situation in either the refugee camps, or many Iraqis actually live not in camps per se, but they live in poor neighborhoods, so they live with relatives, you know, they live in abandoned buildings. And it's extremely grim, and, you know, you have sort of stories of people not having access to clean water, not having access to toilets, and so on. And I think this story of the internally displaced is often forgotten when we talk about Iraq after the invasion. Now, for me, what has become apparent is that despite the rhetoric of liberation that we already listened to, I mean, women were the first ones who were dropped off the agenda when the wider issue of national security was really acute. So lots of money was initially put into Iraq to try to empower women. And what did women's empowerment mean in the first few years? It meant sending women to democracy trainings, often five-star hotels in Jordan or in Lebanon, organizing trainings in terms of income generating, creating women leaders, creating women businesswomen. I mean, it was a kind of convergence of the most overt neoliberal and neoconservative ideas of what empowerment might mean. And it created this small elite class of women who were part of this circuit and did actually go from, you know, one training to the next. But generally speaking, the militarization of Iraqi society, and Toby has written about this as well, one of the side effects of the militarization has been this privileging of a very militarized, patriarchal, authoritarian masculinity. So it's not only that we have had increases in gender-based violence since 2003, but we've also have had, you know, shift towards much more conservative gender norms and relations. And I mean, the 25% quota that we find enshrined in the Iraqi constitution, the quota for women, I mean, I personally have to say I feel agnostic about it, because I know that if it wasn't for the quota, no woman would be involved in parliament or any of the legislative executive bodies. However, I find it problematic to think that numbers will mean that transformation, positive transformation is happening, especially with respect to women's rights and equality. What we see happening in Iraq and also elsewhere in other parts of the world, where quotas are really more used for cosmetic reasons, is that it's often the wives, sisters, daughters of conservative male politicians who end up in parliament, and who are often, like Jamila Al-Obeidi I mentioned in the beginning, might even be promoting ideas and policies that are very contrary to ideas of equality and justice. Now, having said that, Iraqi women have been far from passive victims. From the very beginning, they have mobilized. They have mobilized on the level of political representation. They have mobilized on the level of challenging gender-based violence. And I should say, Iraqi women have also been at the forefront of challenging sectarianism and political authoritarianism. And there has been a coming together of women of different ethnic and religious backgrounds, different political parties, who were able to work together on certain issues. And as Toby mentioned, the popular movement that started in 2015 first in Baghdad, but in other cities as well in Iraq, it is really out of this movement, but similar to other movements in the region, very much anti-establishment, anti-corruption, anti-sectarianism, but also, you know, economic issues, better infrastructure, and so on. It is out of this popular movement that certain political strands have emerged. So I was quite amazed to see that. So this is Hannah Etwar. She is the head of the Shabaka al-Iraqiya, the Iraqi Women's Network, which is a network of over 80 women's organizations. And the Iraqi Women's Network was also involved in the popular movement. But then, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr got involved, and we now know about the coalition between Sadr and the, well, elements of the Iraqi Communist Party. So women were involved. I mean, there were some days when it was very, very male-dominated, but women did come out and did protest very much against sectarianism and authoritarianism. I have to say, so my glimmers of hope, if I have any, do not really are not associated so much with formal politics anymore. I mean, it's too early to know whether anything positive comes out of it. But the glimmers of hope I have link to the large numbers of people, especially young people in Iraq, who on the one side really like to have normal lives. They want to enjoy lives as people everywhere in the world. But also I see an amazing amount of creativity, culture. I mean, historically, Iraqis are known in terms of, especially the visual arts. I mean, the modern, the wave of modern art in the 50s, was kind of picked up across the region. Iraq has also been known in the region in terms of writers, in terms of, very music as well. And so I see here, several art projects, not just in Baghdad, but also in other towns, where young men and young women are expressing themselves in different art forms, are also organizing photography exhibitions, film festivals, exhibitions of their art. If you Google Iraqi art, you will come across many new projects. Sometimes sort of quite daring in terms of what they're representing. And I'm also hopeful in terms of youth culture. So on the one side, there is the kind of more traditional folkloric, let's celebrate our difference. So we have more and more young people who are really fed up with the sectarian politics. But then, there are other Iraqis, and I think it's really important to stress, who are just, want to be teenagers and who have sort of very similar aspirations as, teenagers in many other parts of the world in terms of the music they listen to, fashion, selfies, as you see, very popular. And I think that I find is really very important. I often find that in discussions of Iraq, we categorize people and dehumanize them. And of course, there's lots of suffering. Of course, that's lots of trauma. And of course, I'm particularly worried about now several generations of young Iraqis. Everything, the only thing they've experienced in their lives from being a baby until now is war, conflict, and violence. There are hardly any child psychologists in Iraq. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, there is no post because it's a continuous traumatic stress syndrome, is prevalent. When I speak to Iraqis, everyone has some this anxious, depressed, there are lots and lots of mental health issues. So I'm very, very worried about a new generation, that's also introduced to various forms of religious and political extremism. But at the end of the day, there are also human beings and children who, just want to play and want to sort of continue. And I often, when I speak to Iraqi friends, they tell me, we are not just the victims of this violence. We are also, people with different values, ideas, and aspirations who have dreams and just want to be like everyone else.
Thank you very much. Thank you for both of your overviews. I want to get us started with two questions because it's a chance to pick your brains. The first one is, and I would like to address it to both of you just as an opening question. What is Iraq now? Is it a sovereign state? Is it a legitimate state? You said 44% participation in elections. How should we think about post-occupation Iraq? Or are we witnessing the occupation still? And does it make sense to talk of Iraq as an independent political formation? The second one is perhaps the word we heard most frequently tonight is sectarianism. And this is a question I've been asking myself for a long time, and I want to pick your brains about this. Why did the US and UK choose to institutionalize sectarianism in Iraq? Was it a divide and rule strategy? How did they relate sectarianization with the logic of liberation and the promise of human rights and democracy. And didn't part of Iraqi society participate in that and welcome that as well? So maybe we can start off by that, and then I'll turn to the audience.
So I'm very glad you asked those questions, because they allow me to say something that I forgot to say, which is that while I spent, you know, many years trying to challenge the idea that there was something inherent in Iraqi culture and really tried to look at the impact of the invasion of the occupation, now 15 years afterwards, I'm very frustrated by the fact that many colleagues, many commentators are explaining everything away by reference to the invasion and the occupation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is right. First of all, I think that the invasion and the occupation, from the very beginning, you had Iraqi opposition politicians who were complicit in it. And I hold the political parties, the opposition in London and the States, who were actually very much promoting the invasion of Iraq, as responsible for sectarianism as Americans and the British. I mean, they were pushing it as well. I think that while initially, you know, it was sort of more the political parties, it wasn't very deep, but now I think sectarianism is deeply rooted. I mean, 15 years later, it means something very different. I mean, many, many people, what I call sushi marriages, so people in mixed marriages, secular people, many left Iraq. Many people have experienced sectarian violence, which in turn made them more sectarian. On the other hand, there is also pushback against that, no doubt. In terms of the question, what kind of state is Iraq now? I mean, of course, another big gap in my presentation is the fact that I mainly spoke about central and southern Iraq. I didn't speak about Iraqi Kurdistan. And to my mind, there is no united Iraq anymore. I mean, that is kind of a form, but in terms of actual content, of course, I think that gamble didn't go very well in terms of the referendum. I don't think it's still an occupation. And I think that we need to move away from just speaking about the occupation. I think that we need to look at also the way that Iraqi politicians, militia, and, you know, ordinary people have contributed to the mess that we are in today.
Right, there are two difficult questions that probably need kind of intellectual answers. I think, in the sense, is Iraq sovereign or a legitimate state, kind of begs the question about what a state is, and trying to look at the evolution of the Iraqi state and the Iraqi nation from maybe the late 1800s under Ottoman rule through is also an argument about the Middle East's more general integration into world economic market, into capitalism, into modernist transformation. And I think in my work I've been guilty about trying to judge Iraq by the absence of a state. Mm-hmm. When of course if we recalibrate state theory, understanding the state is always a snapshot of contestation between social movements and those seeking to control them. And so Iraq stateness has waxed and waned depending on where mobilization and the ability to control it is. So it's more institutionally coherent now than it was, but still very fluid. I think if you look at, seek to identify, understand, explain Iraqist nationalism vis-a-vis Arab nationalism and Kurdish nationalism, you can identify all three in the late 1800s. Identify them waxing with the decline of Arab nationalism is the robustness of both the Kurdish nationalism and Iraqis nationalism, which is still there. But of course, then we immediately have to qualify that
without being too instrumental, saying that ideas keep being held and shared by sections of the population, but highly manipulated. I think the referendum, as Oscar Wilde says, scoundrels cloak themselves in the flag, and two very big families of scoundrels, the Barzanis and the Talibanis, cloak themselves in the Kurdish nationalist flag through the referendum to try and get away from their active corruption and complicity in the decline of the Kurdish population of Iraq. Now, it didn't turn out well at all, which I think is a pity, because I think any self-defining group should have the right to secede from the state that it's in, and there's little or no doubt that Iraqi Kurdish nationalism is a vibrant and long force which will see self-determination if that popularity stays. So I think, I don't think occupation is the right term, but I do think, I don't think we can talk about Iraqi sovereignty under siege from the World Bank, under siege from substate forces, under siege from Turkey, under siege from Iran. So it's still a cockpit of competing issues. And then again, sorry to be so obscure, but the argument around sectarianism fascinated us just in the middle of a probably 2-year project on seeking to understand sectarian mobilization. And then when you come to the literature, it's dreadful. It's absolutely dreadful theoretically. You have broadly three schools, one of which the modern school born in LSC, one of which a kind of ethno-symbolic school, also is very, I think, essentialist, that somehow ethnic identities triumph all others. And then there's a rational school, which is very arid, and people swap their identity. So I've, like all confused people, fled into the work of Pierre Bourdieu to try and understand how cognitively the Iraqi population has had this sectarian identity forced upon it in rivalry to three competing nationalisms that I talked about. Now, your question, not to get away with it, is why did the US and the UK adopt a sectarian framework so easily in 2003? And I think, to a large extent, it is the agency of a particular group of Iraqis. Iraqis long exiled from Iraq, the opposition, you go back to the Salahuddin conference, I think, if my memory says you're right, in 1992, where Kurdistan, after 1991, was liberated from Baath's rule. The two dominant Kurdish parties, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the Kurdistan Democratic Party, set up these statelets into which the opposition comes and mobilizes around an ethno-sectarian vision that they very effectively sell to the Americans and the British. So I think, as far as I understand it, sold to the British. Also, it was consumed because of Orientalist vision. Oh, they're Arabs, they're Iraqis, they must be divided, animated by ethnic and religious divisions that we don't have in the West. So you've got things working there. Now, it is said quite frequently by Iraqi pundits as well as others that the 2018 elections were somehow post-sectarian. Mm-hmm. It's the social scientific word for that argument. Rubbish, I think. In that sense that if you look at the mobilization, the dominant mobilization, they're still largely within ethno-sectarian categories of political rhetoric. I think that's another. But the 2015 movement and the movement against sectarian apportionment, the Mahasa movement, against the Mahasa system, arose above, powerfully, as Nadia was saying, above those instrumental and corrupt uses of the term. So there is possibility, there is a challenge, and there is a vibrant alternative in civil society and also the Iraqi nationalism. Whether that can survive where the coercive and to some extent the economic power is in the hands of people promoting secularism, I'm not sure.
Thank you. Any questions from the floor? You left everyone speechless. thank you. Yes.
Save us some silence.
I guess because this question is for Toby Dodge. You talked about the mistakes the Americans made in 2003, tearing down that helped demolish the Iraqi state. But isn't there a question here? Did the Iraqi state collapse in 2003 because the Americans did things like removing the Ba'athists and disbanding the army, which would imply that there was an alternative, they could have done better? Or did the Iraqi state collapse because its essential nature was that it was built around a very personal, corrupt, and brutal regime, and once that regime was removed, all the things that held the state together were gone? In other words, the state was doomed to collapse.
I think it's an excellent question, a fair point for discussion. I think if we look at the evolution of state capacities in Iraq from 68 onwards, I mean, it's a fascinating story from 58 to 63, but we see a few things happening. We see undoubtedly the centralization of power in an authoritarian regime with totalitarian aspiration. That's accelerated with the nationalization of oil and the oil crisis, such a piece of the floor, where you see a quadrupling of money coming into the state. Now, that money is invested in coercion, in military, but also in motorways and in literacy in schools. So it's a kind of a violent, coercive, modernizing project. Saddam Hussein regime won the UNESCO Award for the highest literacy success of anywhere in the world at any time. So it's a very, you know, it's not mixed, it's mainly coercive but other aspects. But of course, then you see a deliberate two-stage process where the Ba'ath Party coerces, co-opts, and takes over the institutions of the state, which is why you end up with a million Ba'ath Party members who want to get on in a career in the Iraqi state and join the party, whether you believe in its nonsense or not. And then after that, after Saddam Hussein takes power in 1979, the Iran-Iraq War, and then onwards, sanctions or whatever, you see the personalization draw into that. All of that is true. So the question is, could the state survive regime change? Well, it's a counterfactual because it didn't, but I would argue it probably could. Now, my argument around 2003 is the looting takes apart in Baghdad at least what's left of the material structure of the state. What de-Ba'athification does is get rid of what's left, which is the institutional memory of the senior technocrats in the state. So you have a quadruple whammy. You have personalization of rule under Saddam Hussein, you have the Ba'ath parties, politicization of rule, you have sanctions, you have de-Ba'athification, you have war, you have all of that coming together. Now, could any state survive that? Probably not. But then you don't go in with a very light force and a view of an occupation that will be measured in months and not years. So the question, I suppose, is could it have been done? And my answer is no, it couldn't have been. So if you're doing it and you misplanned it, then clearly you have a responsibility for the abject mess that happens in its wake.
I tend to agree with that. I opposed the war at the start, but there was a point where I found myself saying, well, we have to stay and try to clean it up, which raises the question, are we capable of cleaning it up? And the answer is probably, no, we're not, but maybe we can keep the violence down to a dull roar until the Iraqis figure it out.
Sure, I was reading, there was a point in 2005-06 when you had a popular and an elite movement in the United States to pull the troops out, Congress, Democrats, whatever. And I looked down the barrel of that gun and I thought, my God, we're in the midst of a civil war. If they go home, that civil war will accelerate. Now, the point you make is a good one. Have they got the ability to sort it out? And it turned out they haven't. Because when they did pull out in 2011, you get the rise of the Islamic State driven by the very structures the Americans put in place. So it's a really difficult ballots, and they came back in 2014 to bomb the Islamic State into defeat, and then they're going again. So in that sense, in the end, Iraq, to a large extent, is going to have to survive on its own in several dynamics or not after the American election.
Yes, I agree. I'd just like to add, so it's one thing to argue that the state might or might not have collapsed depending on what you do. And, but then there's the added element of not only where did the US and also the British Army and education contribute to the, you know, the disintegration of the Iraqi state, but very importantly, they contributed to the sectarian violence. I mean, don't forget, for a long time, Shia Islamists were the good guys. And so, you know, we had actually years when there was Shia Islamist sectarianism, where, you know, Sunni, we don't know, you know, whether they were involved in violence or criminal activities, but people were systematically tortured, killed, arrested without trial, and the Shia militia got away with it because they were the good guys. Now, at some point, when in 2005, 2006, we had Sunni insurgents happening, you know, at a different scale, then, of course, we had the U.S. giving weapons to Sunni Islamist extremists. So, I mean, it's not only that they contributed to the disintegration of the state, but they actively contributed to A, lots of people with lots of weapons, and B, sectarian militia. Yes, please.
I'd like to discuss the relationship between state collapse and sectarianism, and if you think state collapse will always lead to internal conflict based on sectarian lines, and also if the link between Syria and the kind of crisis and civil war there, and how that's linked with Iraq, and how that's kind of intensified the problems.
Thank you. Would you like
this? Yeah, this is a great question. It's one I'm still intellectually wrestling with. So I started out a couple of years ago with a hypothesis, and it's animated a lot of my early work on Iraq, that the structures of the state deliver a unitary nationalism through interpolating, so through recognizing and calling citizens into a unifying arena that solidifies a collective identity. So the recently retired professor of nationalism, John Brewley, there you might have come from the government department, said makes it up. Great. So I went into Iraqi history to prove that hypothesis and couldn't, partly for the reason we're talking about, that the Iraqi state has never been strong enough, institutionalized enough, or legitimate enough to drive that nationalism forward. So again, you have very different currents. So that would be a hypothesis. I don't know enough. And you could argue, potentially, and I'm not an expert on Syria, but I know people who are working on this, that Syria was possibly more statist and had that argument could work, but I couldn't find empirical evidence to prove it in Iraq. What I can find empirical evidence for, and it's kind of more your structural cognition way, is I'm certain that after 2003, the structures that were put in place interpolated individual Iraqis purely and dominated coercively in terms of their substrate identities, the Iraqi movement. So that I can prove. The first argument is saying I can't. So I'm still pondering that.
I mean, I don't think that we can ask this question. We can answer this question in sort of general context. It has to be historicized. So if a state, the Iraqi state or any other state in the Middle East had collapsed, let's say in the 60s, I don't think that sectarianism would be a natural outcome at all. So we have to ask, what at this specific historical moment are the different political projects? At some point we had Arab nationalism. At some point we had socialism. I mean, the political anti-establishment project in the context of post-colonial, authoritarian,
secular regimes is that of Islamism, and it's that increasingly of sectarian Islamism. So it's a specific historical moment in which state collapse, and the state collapse is not any state, it is an authoritarian state that actively oppressed religious tribal authorities, where it's not a coincidence that the opposition was, not all, I mean, there were communists, but there was large Islamist sectarian opposition. I mean, I have to say that I experienced more sectarianism amongst Iraqis in London or in Detroit at a certain moment than in Iraq. So I think we need to be sort of specific.
I'm just going to ask a very general question, and it's about the relationship between Iraqis in diasporic communities and civil society in Iraq. Any elaboration?
Yeah, so pre-2003, there was no civil society in Iraq, and so the relationships between diasporic Iraqis and people inside were either sort of underground political movement in terms of the opposition. But in terms of humanitarian work, there was lots of, especially in the sanctions period, there was lots of humanitarian work. So for example, I mean, my father spent the entire 90s collecting medicine and clothes to send to Iraq, and there were lots of people like that. Now, post-2003 was a mushrooming. Okay, I should say that, of course, in the Kurdish region of Iraq, it's since the 1990s that you have a mushrooming of civil society, and you had many Kurds who had been in the diaspora who went back. And when I did do interviews with people, there was a bit of a sense of resentment of, you know, all these people that come back and took positions. Mm-hmm. Now, that happened much later in central and southern Iraq after 2003. Many Iraqis that I'd known for years were very happy initially and wanted to go back and wanted to help, got involved in all kinds of civil society organizations, whether women's organizations or others. Most of them returned after a few years. Now, they returned for different reasons. One, of course, is because of the violence, but also they didn't feel welcome. And when I spoke to Iraqis who had never left before, they were complaining bitterly about these Iraqi expats who would come back, and they were trying to tell us how to do things, and they were extremely patronizing, and they had no idea about what we went through, and so there are lots of tensions. Having said that, some people, like I showed you the picture of Hanna Edwar, who was the head of the Iraqi Women's Network, she came from outside. I mean, she Iraqi communist. She did initially go to Iraqi Kurdistan, where she started a women's organization. Then after 2003, she went back, and you know, people told me, well, Haifa is different because she's not patronizing, and she actually respects our experiences as well. So now, again, I would say that the main contact and the more sort of productive relations are amongst young Iraqis. So you have lots of young doctors, lawyers, professionals in the UK and other parts of the diaspora who regularly travel to Iraq, who are very much involved, but seem to have a different attitude than the previous generation.
Yes, please.
Over the last hour, both of you have given a sort of a diagnosis of what the current state is. But then, what do you see as the current solution then? Because I think both of you probably have maybe a similar solution. How do things get better? Or what needs to be done?
I personally gave up on answering, feeling that I can answer this question. I mean, I can only say something in terms of, more specifically, in terms of women and gender-based violence. I mean, there I feel what can be done
is to actually support the amazing initiatives that exist in Iraq, as opposed to you know, these international organizations coming in with you know, one recipe fits all. I mean, this is how we are empower women. This is how we are addressing gender-based violence. So I think that what can be done is to actually take local experience and local mobilization more seriously. I think that education is key. So, I mean, I think that in terms of democratization, human rights, it's clearly not, you know, the elections that are going to make a difference. But as I said, my hope is with a new generation of Iraqis, and their, I think, more sort of enabling exchanges, people coming here, people going to Iraq, scholarships. Now, on the sort of big political field, I'm totally, I mean, this, maybe you have some solutions, but I'm...
If you think about Iraq as a country that was invaded by a wholly ignorant imperial power that directed it more, I think that would give us all pause for exogenous modesty, as it were. I mean, I spend a lot of my time seeking to explain what's going wrong. I think, as Nadia was saying, there are incredibly brave, hard-working, idealistic civil society activists working hard there. I think there are, I mean, I was a bit blanket in my condemnation, quite right, I think, of senior politicians, but there are politicians younger, another generation down, across most of the main parties, who kind of profoundly realize that their seniors, their elders, have really screwed this up, and realize that if they do the same, they won't be spending much more time at liberty, let alone in Iraq. So from that point of view, I think there are generational shifts, and I think the mobilization around the 2015 protest movement before it's co-opted by is indicative of a general sense of alienation and anger that came up in the Caribbean forward. What that amounts to, I'm not sure, I worry. So in 2016, I think, is that right? The protest movement with Saleh's backing took over the Green Zone Swire side, Saleh Sistani. Was very damning of the ruling elite, and the Prime Minister of Bali tried to impose a radical policy of reform plan, which in effect would have driven this kleptocratic elite out of power and failed, because it's very difficult to reform that type of system from the inside. I think as Iraqi politicians go, that's not saying a great deal, of Bali has tried to implement some policies that could make things better, but through his own incompetence, but also lack of power and capacity, failed. So, given that the largest part of the largest coalition on low turnout, that I was quite right, has a horrendous history of sectarian violence, is now partnered with the Iraqi Communist Party. My line is, the Iraqi Communist Party always does the right thing for the wrong reasons at the wrong time, and that may be the case here again, but is providing some form of intellectual and strategic muscle to a party that feels it doesn't have it. So you have possibilities. You have potential for coalitions and mobilizations which could drive Iraq in a better direction. But I think it's far from me as a jaded external analyst to suggest which would be the best thing for Iraq to do it.
How about reparations? I mean, isn't it the case that the United States and the United Kingdom wrecked a whole country and society? Shouldn't we be talking about reparations to be paid to?
Sure, I think some form of legal capacity to punish the application of international law, the reckless lack of
planning, the complicity with death squads and militias, all of that, and then leaving for reparations, I think is a wonderful platform from which to mobilize on. But
not if the reparations are being sent to the Iraqi state.
Yes.
Or the Iraqi ruling elite.
Yeah, the Iraqi ruling elite.
It's fascinating to me. Anybody who has studied colonial history can see the pattern here. You go in, you occupy, you colonize, and then you create a right. And then it becomes the responsibility of the so-called native to fix it. Yes.
Hi there. I'm jumping on the bandwagon of looking for solutions and looking ahead. Is there any value you think to address the both of you of look of both the political elites as well as the civil society to look towards the, say, the Persian Gulf states such as Qatar, Oman, the UAE for potential solutions towards the current impasse or the current abject political situation as we've depicted this evening?
Yeah,
is there any, in that sense, like valuable lessons learned that we can pick up from, say, Kuwait and the other Persian Gulf states?
I'll take a response to this if there is any.
There's another question. There.
I'll wait. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that the Arab Gulf states are in a pretty bad mess anyway. And they recognize that, I think, the spending sprees of the oil era are over, and the dabbling in kind of neoliberal reform packages are going to be worse. I think if you look at London, some other countries, Saudi Arabia, you have this kind of modernizing authoritarianism as you do in the United Arab Emirates. That might be a solution for the elite, but I don't see it being a solution. Small population in Saudi Arabia, a larger population. I think that rentierism as a model of development is over, is a lesson that the Iraqi ruling elite, one of the many lessons they should learn. But as we head back to $80 a barrel oil, which apparently we are doing, the temptation to buy off sections of the population through corruption or subsidies and push them. Problem down the road, I think, will come up across the whole of the oil producing world. So give the elite some slack to buy off the opposition to move on to another day. So no.
Well, and to add to that, I mean, historically, I would say that Iraq, unlike the other oil producing states, did not rely on quote-unquote importing labor from outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, one reason we had some form of well, I hesitate to say it, but some form of state feminism where women were pushed into the education system and into the labor force, especially in the 70s, was because Iraq did rely on its own human resources, and that created a very differently educated and skilled population than in some of the other oil-producing countries. So in some ways, I think there should have been a lesson learned the other way around. Of course, now, the other thing I would say is that one of the problems of Iraq is the meddling of many of the Gulf states. I mean, that we haven't talked so much about this, but it's not only, you know, the US and the UK, and it's not only the Iraqi politicians and sectarian militia. It's, of course, many, many other players, regional players. I mean, there's Qatar, there's Saudi Arabia, there's Iran, there's Turkey. That is another layer of complexity.
Mm-hmm. I'll take the last question.
Well, it's a good follow-up on this. I had a specific question on Iran, so we hear a lot about political and economic dimensions of influence of Iran and Iraq.
Oh, thank you. Just could you give us some insights about what are the manifestations on the Iraqi society, and of course whether the shift of the White House on Iran will have any impact on Iraq? Thank you.
Should I just have a first go? I mean, I don't know what Toby thinks, but I mean, one reason that Muqtada Sadr is popular aside from him having attached himself to the anti-corruption, anti-establishment movement, that is Iraqi nationalist as opposed to Iranian Shia. So that's a big thing. There's a strong, amongst many, not just Sunni, but amongst many Iraqi Shia, there's a strong anti-Iranian sentiment, and that's a lot of sense. They're taking over. And so he is seen as a kind of, you know, pushing back. Of course, politically, Iran is still playing a very influential role, both militarily, economically. Culturally, I mean, you know, really going back and moving away from sort of current political, I mean, culturally, there are, of course, many, many links historically and families that have been sort of living across, people moving as well in terms of for pilgrimage purposes and so on.
I mean, there's three arguments here. There's, I think, two parts to the question. The first is, does Iran, as a state, as a government, as a population, have links and legitimate interests in Iraq? And obviously, given the eight-year run of war, these chemical weapons, Iraq being a tool of the international community to smother the Iranian revolution, obviously the answer is yes. Now, I'm saying, societal, economic, religious, cultural integration across that border flow is good to the right, without a doubt. The second thing is that undoubtedly Iran is, I was just looking at the election list on my phone to remind myself that Iran has investment in two of the top four of the election lists that ran, that won the election. Fatah, which is the Hashd al-Shaabi election list in the state of law, run by Nour al-Maliki, and there's an argument in the Twitter sphere that Fatah, state of law, and Abadi's election coalition are trying to be convinced to come together to go to power to cut out the Kurosawa. Qasem Soleimani, the high associate of Iranian politics, always seems to be in Soleimani Iran. So whenever I read someone, oh, he was here yesterday. Oh, was he? I just wish he'd kind of come out, sort of follow me around to have a chat with me, but that was a joke, sorry. I think it's really easy to overstate the conspiratorial microwave. So if you look at the Twitter sphere that exploded up in the 12th election, that's anchored in Washington and somewhat representative of the discussions in Washington, it's empirically an analytic hypothesis. Was this election a victory for Iran? Well, it was an election with many competing forces, some of which relied on Iran, and overstate the hidden hand. Because I think Patrick Coburn, the independent journalist, always said the Americans thought that they could make the weather in Iraq, and they couldn't. And the Americans now think because they can't, the Iranians can. And I think their power also is constrained. Iraq is an Iraqi arena with others coming in. So I think it's easy to overstate that. And as Nader was saying, there is a different shades of Iraqi nationalism. Sada, in his heyday, was often described as xenophobic. He blames the Iranians to some extent for his father's murder under the dying days of war. Came up to be diverse things. So there's that, and that's part of his appeal. But I just would caution against overstating the influence of Iran and seeing Iranian presence as kind of dominant and without fault.
Okay, it's 8:00. Please join me in thanking our speakers and thanking.
Okay.